Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Today we're exploring the historical tapestry of the Kurdish people.
Yeah, not just looking at big events, but focusing on the individuals. They're really remarkable people who shaped Kurdish history and left these lasting legacies.
Exactly. And we have a fantastic collection of sources for this. Historical accounts, modern analyses, all pointing to this really vibrant and influential presence in the Middle East for for centuries.
So our aim today is to pull out the most fascinating insights, right, about famous Kurdish figures across all sorts of fields.
That's the plan. Political leaders, military commanders, scholars, poets, religious thinkers. It's a rich history.
We'll be journeying through time a bit, touching on those ancient connections, the rise of early dynasties, figures who really impacted the wider Islamic world.
And the flourishing of intellectual and literary traditions, too. Plus, looking at leaders who emerged in later times, navigating these big empires, and ultimately contributing to modern Kurdish identity.
Okay, let's get into it. Where do we even start tracing these deep historical roots? It feels daunting.
It is complex, no doubt. You know, directly linking modern groups to specific ancient peoples is always challenging. Millennia pass, people migrate, identities shift.
Sure.
But there's this frequent association of Kurds with the ancient peoples who lived in the Zagros-Taurus region that gives us a kind of foundational narrative, a long-standing presence there.
Right. And one group that always seems to come up is the Karduchoy. Xenophon mentioned them, 401 BCE, way back?
Yes, Xenophon, the ancient Greek writer. He described the Karduchoy as this fiercely independent tribal people.
Living where exactly?
In the mountains north of the Tigris River, so near modern Zaku. He really highlighted their skill in warfare, especially with bows and slings, and their resistance both to the Persian Empire and to his own Greek forces during that famous retreat.
So it paints a picture of like a really resilient mountain people.
Exactly. Adapted to a tough environment.
So the big question, are these the ancient Kurds? Is it a direct line?
Well, that's where the scholarly debate comes in. Opinion is divided. Really.
Okay.
Some historians suggest, yeah, maybe a link. They point to the geography, the shared characteristic of fierce independence in the mountains.
Makes sense.
But others say, hold on, let's be cautious. We don't have definitive proof of a direct genealogical connection.
Right.
What's interesting, though, is centuries later, Roman sources talk about the same general area as Gordiane.
Gordiane!
Yeah. And we even have records, like Kings Arbienus of Gordiane, interacting with Rome back in the first century BCE.
So that suggests some kind of continuity, distinct groups in that area over time.
It suggests that, yes, a continuity of distinct peoples or political entities in that region.
Interesting. So even if we can't draw a straight line, it establishes this long history of independent folks living in that rugged terrain.
What about the Medes? They often get mentioned too, right, in relation to Kurdish origins.
The Medes, yes, a major ancient Iranian people. They built a powerful empire, 7th, 6th centuries BCE. And their territory overlapped with Kurdistan.
Significantly overlapped, yes. With areas that later became associated with Kurds. Their king Cyaxares is really notable.
The Cyaxares.
Around 625 to 585 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
He had major military reforms and played a huge role with the Babylonians in overthrowing the Neo-Assyrian Empire. That was a massive power shift in the ancient world.
Wow. Okay, so what links the Medes and the Kurds? What's the evidence there?
Well, there are several clues.
Yeah.
Geographically, the Median heartland lines up with parts of modern Kurdistan.
Okay.
Linguistically, Median is a northwestern Iranian language, same branch as Kurdish languages.
Out of a language connection.
Yes. And then you have some medieval Armenian texts that actually equate Kurds with Medes.
Really? Explicitly?
Explicitly. Plus, there's even speculation, and it is speculation, about the Kuzkapan tomb in Iraqi Kurdistan, possibly being Cyaxares' burial site.
That's fascinating.
It is. So while it's not definitive proof of direct lineage, all these connections, geography, language, historical references, they suggest a shared cultural and linguistic heritage in the same space.
So putting it together, even with the debates, there's this strong sense of connection to these ancient, resilient, independent mountain peoples. It provides a powerful origin story.
Exactly. A foundational narrative of deep historical roots, that spirit of independence fostered in the mountains, and a distinct identity in a really strategic part of the world.
Okay, let's move forward a bit. Early days of Islam. We find this figure, Jaban al-Kurdi. Who was he? Why is he important?
Jaban al-Kurdi, yes. Also known as Abu Maymun Jaban al-Kurdi. He holds a really significant position because he's recognized as a Sahabi.
A Sahabi, meaning a companion of the Prophet Muhammad.
Precisely. The Sahaba were that first generation of Muslims. They knew the Prophet directly, followed him. Their testimony is foundational to Islam.
Wow. A Kurdish companion. That points to a very, very early connection.
It really does. He's considered one of the earliest non-Arabs to embrace Islam. Mm. And reports say he actually went back to Kurdistan to preach, probably around the 18th year after the Hijra.
So before many of the later conquests in the area.
Yes, predating a lot of that.
Do we know much about his life? Details.
Specifics are a bit limited, as often happens with figures from that far back. But his status as a Sahabi is well documented in key early Islamic sources.
Like who?
Well, the famous scholar Ibn Hajar al-Kolani, for instance, he records that Jibin narrated 10 hadiths.
10 sayings or actions of the Prophet. That's significant.
It is. And Jibin's son, Mimun al-Kurdi, was also respected. He was a Tabi, part of the generation that learned directly from the companions.
So a family commitment early on.
Seems so. And other major historians like Ibn al-Athir and Abu Nu'aym al-Isfahani, they also confirm Jibin's status as a companion.
Symbolically, this feels huge. What does it tell us about Kurds and Islam right at the beginning?
Well, what's really fascinating is it shows this early integration. Kurds weren't just brought into Islam later through conquests. There was engagement from the very start through direct personal connection to the Prophet.
Right.
Having a Kurdish Sahabi provides this deep historical root for Kurdish Muslim identity. It establishes it as, you know, an authentic part of the broader Islamic story from its earliest days.
That's a powerful point. It really anchors that connection right in Islam's formative period.
Okay.
Wait, let's shift focus now to a time when we see distinct Kurdish political entities emerging. These early Kurdish dynasties, 10th to 12th centuries. Mm. Sounds crucial, maybe less known.
Oh, absolutely vital. You have the Abbasid Caliphate weakening, right? Its central control is fading.
Mm-hmm.
And this allows regional powers to rise up all over the Middle East and the Caucasus. And amidst all this, several Kurdish dynasties appear in areas like modern Western Iran, Northern Iraq, parts of the Caucasus.
Showing real political and military strength.
Definitely. Initiative and strength. Okay, tell us about some of these key players. The outline mentions, let's see, Shaddadids, Marwanids, Rawadids, Hazanwayhides, Anasids. Quite a few.
It is quite a few, yeah. Each carved out its own niche. The Shaddadids, 951 to 1199, roughly. Mm. They set up shop in parts of Armenia and Iran.
Key figures.
Muhammad ibn Shaddad founded it. Later rulers like Fadli were important. He even minted his own coins in Drivan.
A sign of independence.
A definite sign. They interact a lot with Armenia and Georgian kingdoms nearby. And later, they had to acknowledge the Seljuks, the big power at the time.
And interestingly, they ruled over mostly Armenian populations in some areas.
In key urban centers, yes.
Yeah.
That's an interesting dynamic.
Okay, what about the Marwanids, centered in Diyarbakir?
That's right. The Marwanids, 983 to 1085. They controlled a big chunk of Upper Mesopotamia. Diyarbakir is their base.
Any particular at that point?
Definitely under Nasr al-Dawla Ahmad ibn Marwan. His long reign is seen as a golden age. His court in Amid became this real cultural hub. Attracted big names, like the historian Ibn al-Athir we mentioned earlier. And like the Shaddadids, they eventually recognized Seljuk overlordship, too.
Okay. The Rawadids next. Their origins seem a bit debated.
Yes, the Rawadids roughly 900 to maybe 1070 or even 1116 in places. Based in Azerbaijan, Tabriz was a key city.
And the debate is
whether they were originally an Arab-Azdi tribe that sort of became Kurdish through intermingling, or if they had earlier links to the Hadabani Kurds. It's an ongoing discussion.
Key rulers.
Abu Mansur Wasudan was significant. He had to deal with the Oghuz Turks, the Seljuks, complex times. And Amadil ibn Ibrahim even fought against the early crusaders down in the Levant.
Wow. Then the Hazanwayhides in western Iran. They were Shia, which is a bit different from the others.
It does distinguish them. The Hazanwayhides, around 959 to 1015, a Shia dynasty in the Zagros Mountains area. Dinavar, Sharizor.
Any standout ruler?
Badr ibn Hasanway. He's remembered really well for bringing order, good financial management, building infrastructure, roads, bridges.
Practical stuff.
Very practical. Making pilgrimage routes safe. And again, issuing his own coins.
And what happened to them?
Their lands eventually got absorbed by neighbors. Anasids, Bayids, Kakuids, Seljuks. The usual story in that era.
Okay, finally the Anasids. On that Iran-Iraq frontier. Sounds like a tough spot.
It was. The Anasids, about 990 to 1117. A Sunni dynasty in a strategic but often unstable border zone. Kermanshah, Mulwan.
Any notable reigns?
Esam Abdallah, Abulak Faris had a particularly turbulent time. Lots of conflict, not just with neighbors like the Kakuids and the rising Seljuks, but even with his own brother, Muayil.
Internal struggles, too.
Very common back then. They eventually succumbed to Seljuk power as well.
So, stepping back, what's the real significance of this whole period, these early Kurdish dynasties?
Well, it clearly shows a significant Kurdish capacity for political organization, for military action, and this persistent drive for self-governance in their homelands.
They weren't just isolated groups.
Not at all. They were active players in the whole medieval Middle East and Caucasus scene, interacting with big empires, showing signs of sovereignty like courts and coinage. And the diversity, different religious affiliations, those debated origins, it just highlights how multifaceted Kurdish society and identity already were back then. It really lays important groundwork for later Kurdish history.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh, Hannah.
Rojbosh.
Hannah has brought us a much-needed chai. Oh, this smells absolutely heavenly. Is that a hint of rose water I detect today?
Takes a sip.
Mmm, yeah, it is. Right? I believe so. It's got a wonderful floral aroma.
How is it? Brewed well.
And it's perfectly brewed today. Not too strong, not too weak. Just the right amount of sweetness. Savoring this.
Agreed. It's got that lovely warmth that just makes you feel good. Perfect for continuing our historical exploration. Okay, Hannah, see you, see you later.
See you, Bosch. Okay, perfect timing for a recharge.
Definitely. All right, where were we? Ah, yes, these early Kurdish dynasties and their significance. And then sort of rising from this milieu, we get a figure who becomes, well, legendary, both East and West.
Saladin.
Yusuf ibn Inayam.
Yes.
Alchemist of 1137, 1193. A towering figure, absolutely celebrated in Islamic and European history.
And confirmed Kurdish origin, right? Tell us about his background.
Yes, born in Tikrit, modern Iraq. His family was Kurdish, from the Rawadiya tribe, with roots near Dlavin in Armenia.
His father was a commander.
His father, Najm ad-Din Ayyub. Yes, a respected military man. Saladin himself got early military experience under his uncle, Asad ad-Din Shirku, who served the Zingid ruler Nur ad-Din.
But I heard he was initially more into scholarship.
That's what accounts suggest. Mm-hmm. More inclined towards religious studies initially. Quran, Islamic law, Arab genealogies, history, poetry.
Multilingual too.
Fluent in Kurdish and Arabic, understood Turkish and Persian. Reflects that cosmopolitan environment.
So how does this scholar become the sultan who takes on the crusaders and recaptures Jerusalem? That's quite a shift.
Well, his rise really started in Egypt, 1169. He gets appointed vizier, chief minister, after his uncle dies.
Okay.
And he was smart. Consolidated power, promoted Sunni Islam, replacing the Shia Fatimid Caliphate, which he abolished in 1171, then declared himself sultan of Egypt, founded the Ayyubid dynasty.
And from Egypt, he expanded.
Massively. Unified Muslim territories. Syria, Damascus, Hama, Homs, Aleppo, Mosul, brought them under his control.
And then the big one, Hattin.
The Battle of Hattin, 1187. A landmark victory against the Crusader armies.
Which led directly to Jerusalem.
Paved the way, yes. He recaptured Jerusalem later that year, October 2nd. A huge turning point in the Crusades.
And his treatment of the city's people, I remember reading it, was very different from the Crusader conquest almost a century before.
Night and day, really.
Uh-huh.
Saladin showed remarkable magnanimity, especially towards the Christian population. He let many ransom themselves and leave peacefully.
Mm.
He also allowed Jewish people to resettle in the city. A stark contrast to 1099, when the Crusaders massacred Muslims and Jews.
Then came the Third Crusade, Richard the Lionheart. That must have been an epic confrontation.
It absolutely was. Intense fighting battles like Arsuf, Jaffa. But what's also fascinating is this mutual respect that developed between Saladin and Richard I.
Really? Respect?
Yes. They negotiated, exchanged gifts even. The truce of 1192 let Christian pilgrims visit Jerusalem, while the Crusaders kept a coastal strip.
Saladin died not long after in 1193. How is he remembered? What's his legacy?
Died in Damascus. He's revered across the Muslim world for his piety, justice, chivalry, even towards enemies.
And his Kurdish identity.
A huge point of pride for Kurds. Interestingly, he was also respected, even romanticized, in medieval Europe. And much later, the Eagle of Saladin became a symbol of Arab nationalism in the 20th century. Shows his wide influence.
Did the Ayyubid dynasty continue strongly after him? Other notable Kurdish figures in it?
Yes. The dynasty lasted for several more generations. His brother, Al-Adil I, was important. His nephew, Al-Kamil Muhammad, famous for diplomacy with Emperor Frederick II. Turan Shah conquered Yemen, Al-Mu'azzam Isa was a big patron of architecture and learning in Damascus.
So Saladin wasn't an isolated case. It was part of a broader Kurdish contribution to leadership in the region.
Exactly. Saladin's story just vividly shows how Kurdish figures could rise to not just regional power, but have a massive impact on the wider Islamic world. He united diverse Muslim forces, showed her Kurdish leadership on a grand scale, and founded a major state.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Moving beyond politics and military, the sources highlight this really rich tradition of Kurdish scholars, poets, historians, the intellectual side.
Oh, definitely. Huge contributions there. History, poetry, often Sufi influenced Islamic sciences, general scholarship.
And many were multilingual.
Very much so. Kurdish, Persian, Arabic, yeah. And engaging with all these different intellectual streams. And some were really key in nurturing the Kurdish language and history itself.
Let's talk about some names. Ali ibn al-Athir, the historian.
Ali ibn al-Athir, 1160 to 1233. Born near modern Sizr. Became a hugely influential historian writing in Arabic.
His major work?
Al-Kamil fi al-Tariq, The Complete History. It's a massive universal history, absolutely essential for understanding the medieval Islamic world, including the Crusades. He also wrote specific histories, like on the Zengids of Mosul, and biographies of the Prophet's companions.
Oh, is he Kurdish?
Well, he's primarily described as Arab. From the Banu Bakr tribe, but some sources mention Kurdish origins or connections in his family. It just shows how complex ethnic identities could be in that region.
Okay. Then Sharaf Khan Bidlisi, author of the Sharafnama, that sounds like a cornerstone text for Kurdish history.
It absolutely is. Sharaf Khan Bidlisi, 1543 to about 1603. He was a Kurdish emir himself, emir of Bitlis, navigated the politics between the Safavids and Ottomans.
And the Sharafnama.
Completed in 1597, written in Persian. It's foundational. It details the history of various Kurdish dynasties, principalities, including the Ayyubids. Writing in Persian gave it wider reach, more prestige.
And then Mastura Ardalan, a female historian. That's incredible for the time.
Truly remarkable. Mastura Ardalan, 1805 to 1848, also known as Masharaf Khanum Kurdistani, a highly educated Kurdish poet, historian, writer from the Ardalan Principality in Iran.
From the aristocracy.
Yes. Fluent in Kurdish, Arabic, Persian. Her Tariqi Ardalan, The History of the Ardalan Dynasty, is invaluable for understanding her family's rule and the Kurdish context of that era.
One of the first female historians in the Middle East.
Considered so, yes. And she was a prolific poet, too. Over 20,000 lines in Persian and Guarani Hirami Kurdish. Notably open in expressing her femininity in her work.
Amazing. Let's turn to poetry. Malay Jaziri seems foundational for Kurmanji Kurdish literature.
Absolutely pivotal. Mm-hmm. Malay Jaziri around 1570 to 1640. Born Ahmad Nishani from Sizri in the Ottoman Empire. A profound Sufi poet.
His key work.
His Diwan, a collection of his poems. It's the first known compiled Diwan in the Kurmanji dialects, a huge milestone.
And he used classical forms.
Yes, he systematically used forms like the Qasida and Ghazal, usually found in Persian and Arabic, but in Kurdish. His poetry is deeply Sufi, Naqshbandi order, full of themes of divine love, ecstasy.
And he influenced later poets.
Profoundly. Seen as the founder of a distinct Kurdish literary school. He influenced Emedi Zani, for example.
Okay. And Fakih Tehran, another major classical poet.
Fakih Tehran, 1590 to 1660, born Mir Mehmed from Hakkari. Also had a madrasa education, might have even studied under Jaziri.
Known for what kind of works?
Famous for the epic poem Zembil Firosh, a love story. Also Strugo Shekisitnan, Queli Hesperesh, and Beta Dimdim, which is the first literary account we have of the Battle of Dimdim in the early 1600s.
So a pioneer of Kurdish Sufi literature.
Yes, and just a foundational figure in classical Kurdish writing. Used relatively plain language, brought in folklore, alongside themes of mysticism, love, nature, wisdom.
And that brings us to Emedi Zani, author of Mimizin, often called the Kurdish national epic.
Emedi Zani, 1650 to 1707. A preeminent figure, intellectual, scholar, mystic, poet. Active around Bayezid.
Educated.
Yes, in religious schools. Worked as a secretary, then a teacher. His masterpiece is Memuzin, finished in 1692.
More than just a love story.
Oh, much more. It's considered the national epic. But beyond the tragic romance, it contains these deep reflections on Kurdish disunity, subjugation, a real yearning for a unified Kurdistan under Kurdish rule, promoting Kurdish language and culture.
So proto-nationalist ideas.
Often seen that way, yes. A key figure in the development of Kurdish national consciousness. He also wrote other important works, like Nubihar Bisukan, an Arabic-Kurdish vocabulary for kids, and religious poems used in schools.
It's just incredible, this intellectual flourishing alongside the political history. What about scholars in other fields? Abu Hanifa Dinawari sounds like a polymath.
An extraordinary polymath, yes. Abu Hanifa Dinawari, roughly 815, the late 890s, early 900s, from Dinawar near Kermanshah, historically Kurdish area.
What were his fields?
So many. Astronomy, agriculture, botany, metallurgy, geography, math, history. He studied widely.
Any standout works?
Especially famous for his Kitab al-Naba, the Book of Plants, a foundational work in botany. Also wrote a major history, Kitab al-Akhbar al-Iwa.
And his background?
It's debated. Some sources say Persian, others Arab of Persian ancestry. But his connection to the Dinawar region, historically Kurdish, is significant.
Okay. And Ibn al-Salah al-Shirazuri. Important in hadith studies.
Very distinguished. Ibn al-Salah, around 1181 to 1245, a Kurdish Shafi scholar, specialized in hadith and law.
Where is he from?
Born near Erbil, raised in Mosul, became prominent in Damascus, headed the Dar al-Hadith al-Ashrafiya, a top hadith center.
His major contribution?
His Muqaddima fa ul-Mawlidi, the introduction to the science of hadith, became a cornerstone text for hadith methodology. Still studied today. He also wrote on Shafi law, Quranic commentary, and notably opposed integrating logic and philosophy too heavily into Islamic legal thinking.
Finally, Al-Mawardi, famous for political theory, Kurdish origin.
Al-Mawardi, 974 to 1058, an eminent Sunni polymath jurist, theorist, theologian, sociologist, political scientist. Born in Basra, worked in Baghdad for the Abbasid caliphs, became chief judge.
His key work?
Al-Akam al-Sultaniya, the Ordinances of Government, foundational text on Sunni political thought. Huge impact.
And Kurdish connection.
Some later sources claim it, but the primary historical sources identify him as Arab. Those later claims aren't really substantiated. It just, again, shows the complexities we talked about.
This whole overview, though, it really highlights this vibrant intellectual life. Multilingual scholars contributing both to specific Kurdish culture, like Sani and Jaziri fostering the language, and to the broader Islamic civilization.
Absolutely. And those complexities around origins just remind us how interconnected things were back then.
Okay, let's shift to later eras. Kurdish leadership within bigger empires, eventually leading towards modern nationalism. Karim Khan Zand is interesting here.
Karim Khan Zand, yes. Ruled Persia, modern Iran, from 1751 to 1779, founder of the Zand dynasty.
His background?
From the Lak tribe. Sources suggest they might have originally been Kurdish. He rose up after Nader Shah's assassination.
When he didn't call himself Shah.
No, interestingly, he used the title Vakil ul Ruaya, representative of the people, made Shiraz his capital, developed the city.
How is his reign remembered?
Generally, quite positively. A time of relative peace, security, economic recovery, seen as a just, benevolent ruler. His Kurdish or Lak origins show that leadership potential within a big Persian empire. The dynasty faded after him, though.
Then Idris Bitlisi in the Ottoman context sounds like he played a really key diplomatic role.
Hugely influential.
Yeah.
Idris Bitlisi, about 1457 to 1520, Ottoman Kurdish scholar, administrator, historian.
What was his major achievement?
After the Ottomans beat the Safavids at Chaldiran in 1514, Bitlisi was crucial in forging an alliance between the Ottomans and many Kurdish emirs.
How did that work?
He negotiated deals. Basically, Kurdish emirs got hereditary rule, some autonomy, in return for recognizing Ottoman sovereignty. It helped bring large Kurdish areas into the Ottoman sphere. He also led Kurdish forces in capturing places like Diyarbakir, and he wrote important histories in Persian about the Ottomans.
Okay, fast forward a bit. Sheikh Ubaidullah of Neri, a key figure in the shift towards modern nationalism.
Definitely seen that way. Sheikh Ubaidullah, 1826 to maybe 1883 or 84, a powerful Kurdish landowner, very influential Naqshbandi Sufi leader from Shemdinan.
Considered the leader of the first modern Kurdish nationalist struggle?
Widely considered so, yes. Yeah. Initially backed the Ottomans, but then aimed for an independent Kurdish state.
His revolt.
The big one was 1880-1881, aimed to carve out a Kurdish state in northwestern Iran. Had some initial success, but ultimately suppressed by Ottoman and Persian forces.
So even though it failed, it was a turning point.
A crucial one. Marked a shift towards explicit national self-determination, a unified Kurdish political goal. He was exiled by the Ottomans eventually.
And the 19th and 20th centuries saw many other leaders continue this struggle.
Oh, absolutely. A whole series of figures. Vadir Khan Beg in Botan in the 1840s, mm-hmm. Sheikh Mahmud Barzanji in southern Kurdistan after World War I, proclaiming a Kingdom of Kurdistan.
Twice, wasn't it?
Twice, yes. Then you have Mustafa Barzani, obviously an iconic 20th century figure, leader of the KDP, decades of struggle in Iraq, Qazi Muhammad and the Republic of Mabad in 46.
Tragically short-lived.
Indeed. Sipko Shikak in Iran after World War I. Sheikh Said leading the major rebellion in Turkey in 1925. The list goes on.
It really shows that evolution, doesn't it? From those earlier dynastic goals to explicit modern nationalist movements seeking self-determination on a national scale.
Exactly. These leaders were often combining traditional authority tribal religious with modern nationalist ideas, influenced by what was happening globally, ideas of nationhood, and of course the huge impact of redrawing the maps of the Middle East after World War I.
And it underscores that persistent Kurdish desire for autonomy and the immense challenges faced.
Precisely. A recurring theme throughout this history.
You know, looking back across everything we've discussed today, there's this incredibly powerful, consistent thread running through Kurdish history. It's the impact of these remarkable individuals.
It really is striking. From those ancient leaders we can only glimpse, to modern activists, brilliant scholars, visionary poets, just this enduring capacity for leadership, for intellectual achievement, for cultural creativity.
And we've seen how they haven't just shaped their own communities, but played really significant roles in the wider Middle East and Islamic history, too.
Absolutely. Establishing dynasties, contributing foundational works of scholarship, leading movements for autonomy. Their legacies are undeniable. They continue to resonate today.
The stories of all these figures, they just powerfully underscore the resilience, the enduring spirit of Kurdish identity, often against incredibly difficult odds.
Mm-hmm.
It really makes you think about the impact individuals can have on history, doesn't it? The power of cultural aspirations, political goals.
Mm, it does. And perhaps a final thought for you listening. What does this incredible range of achievements and struggles across so many centuries tell you about the forces that really shape history and about the enduring spirit of a people seeking their place in the world?
A profound question indeed, something to reflect on as you continue exploring the rich, complex history of this region.